is Hazel Kahn, and you're tuned to Tidings. My guest today is Dugald Hine, who is connected to us via Skype from Västerås in Sweden. Dugald is co-founder with Paul Kingsnorth of Dark Mountain, a new cultural movement that began in England a few years ago. In 2012, Dugald was named one of 50 leading radicals by The Observer. Welcome to Tidings, Dugald. I'm really looking forward to what you're going to be telling our listeners today.
Hi, Hazel. It's very nice to be with you.
I'd like to just start from the beginning. You're actually from England originally.
That's right. I grew up in the northeast of England in a town called Darlington, and I studied English literature at university and fairly soon afterwards went on to work for the BBC as a radio journalist. But I parachuted out of that career fairly quickly because it felt like a lot of what we spent our time doing was really mining the raw experience of people's lives, often at difficult times in their lives, to turn into this sort of industrial product of news that would hold people's attention between the weather forecast and the travel news. So I guess at that point in my mid-20s, I was left with this challenge of, what do we do with this thing called life? Once the successful career option that, you know, your friend's parents and your parents' friends think, you know, he's doing well for himself, once you've tasted that and found it wanting, what's left that does make sense? And so that started me on the path towards the kind of writing that I've been doing and the work that I've done over the last few years, starting different kinds of projects and organizations, Dark Mountain being probably the best known of those. And then just to answer the obvious question, how does an Englishman end up in Sweden? Well, I had 5 very busy years in London when I founded Dark Mountain and was working on various other projects. And towards the end of that time, when I was already fairly ready to leave, I met a Swedish woman, and she was living in Sweden and I was living in London, and neither of us liked a life that involved lots of international travel, and it turned out it really wasn't that difficult a decision to move here. So I left London just over 2 years ago, and I'm slowly arriving in Sweden.
Mm. The thing that first intrigued me when I learned about Dark Mountain was what that journey was from environmental activism to Dark Mountain, because you didn't include that when you just, you know, summarized your life. You didn't include the environmental activism, but that was what you were doing at some stage too.
Absolutely. Yeah, that was something that I'd been involved in from during my time at university, and then something I guess I got more involved in at the point where I had left my career at the BBC. And I think many of us have had the moment where climate change suddenly hits us as something real and terrifying, and you go through that phase of, you know, switching off every light switch that you see that's been left on. And I remember I used to be in the newsroom at the end of the day, climbing up on the desks to switch off every monitor and every news screen around the newsroom that people had left on before I went home for the night. And the other people who were on the late shift used to think I was crazy. And then you reach some point where you go, wow, however many screens and light switches I switch off, this isn't going to be enough. And I went through several years of being quite heavily involved in environmental activism. And I guess by the point that Paul and I met and started having the conversations that led to Dark Mountain, one of the things we had in common was that we'd both begun to realize that the environmental movement was in danger of becoming like a church where the priests have lost their faith, but they don't think the congregation are ready to hear the news. A lot of the people we knew who were most deeply immersed in what was coming out of the scientific research, who were most prominent as figures standing up and speaking at events, were standing up and saying things like, we can prevent climate change. And if you met them quietly when they were off duty in a pub and had a conversation with them, actually a lot of them were reaching a point of despair. But there seemed to be no way of articulating that. And so the gap was growing between the public rhetoric and the place where a lot of people were at in terms of, you know, what they actually thought the situation we were in was. And so that was the starting point of Dark Mountain, I guess.
The idea of stopping climate change, now I suppose it's more about slowing it down. Your same objections apply.
I think one thing that's noticeable over the last 5 years is that the idea of preventing or stopping climate change has sort of disappeared from the way that people are talking about it. But I mean, there's a passage from Mike Hume, who he was the founding director of the Tyndall Center for Climate Research. He's now a professor at King's College London. So he's one of the scientists who has been at the heart of climate research. And there's a passage of his which actually, for me, sums up a lot of what we were trying to say when we started out with Dark Mountain. He says, climate change is not a problem waiting for a solution. It is an environmental, cultural, and political phenomenon which is reshaping the way we think about ourselves, our societies, and humanity's place on Earth. So a lot of what we were saying when we started out, when we wrote the manifesto, was, you know, we need to stop talking as if this is a problem that we can solve with a set of technical and political and economic solutions, and we can somehow make our current way of living sustainable. Whatever comes out the far side of this rough ride that we're already on, it's going to bring pretty much everything that we grew up taking for granted into question. And one of the key lines in the Dark Mountain Manifesto, for me, came right at the end when we said, the end of the world as we know it is not the end of the world, full stop. And I think being able to make that distinction between losing lots of the things we grew up taking for granted, having lots of the things that constituted the world as we know it thrown into question, without mistaking that for the apocalypse or the imminent extinction of humanity, I think that's really important. That's something that we've been trying to open the space for through the work we've been doing with Dark Mountain.
I think we still need for you to talk about what Dark Mountain is and what the manifesto is. How did the whole thing start?
So Dark Mountain began, I guess, about 7 years ago now, when Paul Kingsnorth and I were reading each other's blogs. And he was a fairly well-known environmental journalist in Britain. We'd never met at that stage, but we'd both been involved in similar campaigns and movements, and we were both writing about some of the same issues and realized that we were converging on some similar ideas. And because we're both writers, when we met and we started talking about this sense that there needed to be other stories, other ways of speaking about the crisis that we were facing than the ones that seemed to be available to the public figures, the spokespeople for the movements we've been part of, our natural instinct was to say, well, okay, let's create a journal. Let's create somewhere where we're not just publishing what the two of us are thinking and saying about this, but somewhere that can be a home for lots of other people. And we had this sense that people were hungry for another kind of conversation about the converging crises, of which climate is only the starkest, but you know, the unraveling of the social and economic and ecological fabric of the world in which we've grown up. So we wrote the manifesto and put that out there as an invitation. We said, you know, this is not a manifesto with a set of action points. We're not trying to unify people around a political platform. This is a cultural manifesto, a call for a new kind of conversation. It's like raising a flag so that we can find each other. And if this is something that is resonating with you, then get in touch. And what happened was that hundreds of people responded to that, such that we had enough material to start publishing this journal, the sixth issue of which is currently being put together and will be coming out this autumn. And every issue of Dark Mountain is a hardback book full of stories in the form of essays, in the form of fiction and nonfiction, dialogues, poetry, images, from different angles of people trying to make sense of what it means to live in this time of unraveling and uncertainty, to not be in denial about how deep the mess is that we're in, to be willing to actually face the darkness of it and let our eyes adjust and see what we start to notice, and to look for where the seeds of hope or the paths that might lead into the unknown world that comes after the end of the world as we knew it, to look for where those might begin. It is, I think, for a lot of us more difficult to imagine a world in which things continue slowly and sometimes more rapidly unraveling things that we used to be able to rely on within our societies, within our neighborhoods, perhaps are not there in the way that they used to be. That kind of steady harshening, in some ways, it's in the face of that that people are embracing apocalyptic fantasies.
Because at least then it'll be an end to all of this.
Yeah, it's the sort of Hollywood drama of the apocalypse that people are attracted to, not the grim reality of making life work day after day. And the question for us is, how do you go on finding meaning and making sense of your life in circumstances where lots of the things that you grew up being told were the places to look to for meaning and validation are not delivering for people the way that they used to?
So how do you find that meaning for living in the ruins?
Well, I guess the question of how do we find and make meaning has a lot to do with the people around us and the extent to which we can find each other. You know, it's a lot easier to get poorer together than it is to do it in isolation. In a lot of ways, the challenge that we have for the next generation is, how do we do a good job of getting poorer? How do we make the best of the circumstances under which we find ourselves without deluding ourselves that it's all moving to some other platform of value and that the economic unraveling isn't something which has really harsh effects for a lot of us? Remembering some of the ways in which people have always made life work and found meaning together, which includes the stories that we tell ourselves, the stories by which we make sense of our lives. What we're saying is, we always live by myths. The question is, are the myths that we're living by, do they fit the territory? You know, the myths are the maps. The whole terrain of experience is overwhelmingly complex. We live by these simplifications in the same way as a map is a simplification of a landscape. I think the difficulty we've got into is twofold. One, that we have myths which are increasingly at odds with the reality of experience for more and more people. And the myth of progress is one of those. And two, that we have myths that we don't even recognize are myths. And one of the most powerful ones is the story that we've been telling ourselves since the Enlightenment within Western culture, which is that we used to live by myths. We used to live by stories because we didn't have science. But now we're capable of knowing things directly, face to face. And so we either have stripped away the myths, or we can and should strip away the myths. And that, you know, that's another story in itself, which is not to say that science doesn't deliver us facts and knowledge that can play an important part in getting our bearings. Even the big stories that wear the robes of science belong to the territory of myth rather than to the territory of the kinds of things that science itself is good at.
Is there an example like that that you could give?
I think the obvious example is the role that somebody like Richard Dawkins plays as a kind of evangelical preacher of a grand narrative, which takes a lot of its authority from science, but which massively exceeds the kinds of knowledge and the kinds of facts that science itself is capable of delivering. You know, what Dawkins is offering is a worldview, and science is not productive of worldviews.
Dugald Hein is talking to us from Sweden about the Dark Mountain cultural movement. This is Tidings on WPKN Radio.
Do you want to talk about the manifesto and what it covers?
So the manifesto, it starts out from trying to name the extent to which our way of living rests on the foundations of our ability to believe that things will go on much as they are. And a lot of the time, that's a reasonable belief. And then there are points at which suddenly that confidence, that certainty is undermined by events. We were writing this in the autumn of 2008. So we were watching a wave of that playing out within the global economic system, the consequences of which we're still living with. And these myths that are both often just taken for granted as how reality is, but that are also like maps that have become increasingly a bad fit to the territory of the world that we actually find ourselves in. So the first of those myths is the myth of progress, this idea that there is some kind of trajectory to history, the idea that we can reduce history to this ascent of man, if you like. One of the reasons why I have a problem with the myth of progress is because it turns the past into this junkyard full of poorer versions of the present, abandoned prototypes for the way that we happen to live now. And I actually think if things are going to turn out less badly than it looks like in the years ahead, it will be because, amongst other things, we've remembered how to look to the past as a library full of different ways in which people have responded to the questions of how we find meaning, and not in any sense to imagine that you can go back to or would want to go back to how people have lived in any particular previous time or place. But there are things there which are not simply poorer versions of the way we do things now, but which are different. So we talk about the myth of progress. We also talk about the myth that there is this thing called nature that is separate from us, and that we are in some sense able to control it, that there is some kind of human destiny to master it and use it to our own purposes. And a lot of what we're saying in the manifesto is, again, if we're going to make a better job of navigating the times ahead than it looks like we're doing, this will probably have to involve a humbler picture of our role in relation to this world in which we find ourselves than the picture which has dominated the societies that we've had for the last few lifetimes. The kind of invitations that we're making in the manifesto are to this naming of dominant myths, not simply because they are myths and we should get rid of all myths, but because we should be aware of the myths that we're choosing to live by, and we need to retell some of the old stories, find new ways of telling stories, find other myths that might fit better the territory into which we're heading.
So is one of the myths sustainability? It seems to me that sustainability implies that we want to get back to where we were.
Exactly. Sustainability has built into it this idea of sustaining something. And even though in its origins it was thinking about how to sustain and make sustainable ecological systems, it so easily slips as a term into meaning sustaining our current way of living at all costs.
There is a darkness about all of this, and the darkness is, of course, real. You've been accused of being nihilistic or pessimistic, the movement, the Dark Mountain movement. Is that how you see it, or are you advocating new ways of living, or is that just the wrong way to look at what your remit is, if you will?
Well, I don't think we're advocating a grand plan for anything. All we've ever done is say we want to open up this space of conversation through publishing, through events, this space within which people can talk about the darkness without being immediately told to shut up. You know, people, when we started out, would say to us, okay, you know, you've burnt out, just go away and sit in a corner, but don't make a noise about it, and encourage other people to give up. And giving up was a term which was used a lot in relation to Dark Mountain. But anyone who describes Dark Mountain as nihilistic or pessimistic probably hasn't had much contact with it. They probably haven't read very much of the work we've actually published. They almost certainly haven't ever come to an event and met the people who've been involved in, drawn into the project. And I would say those people are overwhelmingly also people who are involved in things, often at a very grassroots level in the places where they live. Some of them also at a very international scale. So these are people who are highly active. This idea that there is a kind of polarization between activism on the one hand, and then Dark Mountain, which is this movement of people who've given up and are telling other people to give up. It's not that simple. I can understand why on first impressions people may take it that way. But as Paul would say, the only thing that he's given up on is things that he doesn't believe work anymore. He's still, and we're still very much looking for things that seem worth doing. But what we're not doing is saying we're a campaign that is going to give you a list of 10 things you ought to do. Another line that we picked up from John Michael Greer that I like, he talks about the importance of dissensus rather than consensus, that in the kind of chaotic, unpredictable, complex messy situation that we're in, the last thing we need to do is have a big meeting and decide on a common plan. We need to be trying all of these different things at once, because we can't answer in advance which of the responses, which of the kinds of action and activity are going to turn out to be the one that surprises us all by making a difference as this plays out. It's not to say that, you know, we can't exercise any discrimination and judgment, but actually that needs to be done at a relatively micro scale. You know, that's a question we have to answer for ourselves and with the people around us, rather than once and for all and for everyone, and then try and communicate that to everybody else.
Is that also a myth that we've been living under, that we can do things as communities and as groups?
Well, we can certainly do things as communities and as groups, but the larger the scale gets, the further it tends to get from reality, or at least the narrower the kinds of actions that can have reality are. There are some things that do work really effectively at national and international scales, but there are also lots of things that just disappear, and often those include some of the things that matter most within the experience that we have at the only level we actually exist at, which is the level of human beings talking to each other, meeting each other one-to-one. So it's not that we're arguing for any kind of radical individualism, but there's a whole lot of space between radical individualism at one end and the idea that we can have some great debate or decision-making process and come up with collective answer on behalf of all of us. And it's sort of, again, in that space in the middle that I think we're trying to operate.
So do you consider yourself a publisher, basically?
Well, the main activity that we do is that we publish a series of books. And then surrounding that activity of editing and curating and publishing, we have this community of people who are engaged in different ways with the conversation, which Dark Mountain has set out to start. And if that wider kind of cultural surrounding disappeared, there would be no point in going on publishing the books. But the books provide a certain kind of focus to that larger conversation.
And that conversation takes place in real time, doesn't it?
It takes place in all sorts of ways. So for 4 years, we organized a Dark Mountain Festival in the UK. And last year we said, well, that's the last year we're going to do that ourselves in that format. Paul and myself and lots of the others around Dark Mountain get involved in other people's events. So I've just spent 4 days on an island in the Stockholm archipelago, bringing together a whole set of conversations, which were not being done in the name of Dark Mountain. They were within a festival with the rather less dark name of Future Perfect. And so that's one way that the Dark Mountain conversation goes on. But it goes on every time that somebody picks up a copy of Dark Mountain and gets talking to somebody else about it, or sends us an email, or writes something online about it. So it takes many forms, some of which we will never hear about.
Well, one of them is taking place right now as we speak, isn't it?
Absolutely.
The conversation that started this whole thing was between you and Paul as two people. Now you obviously became friends, but there's something in the idea of friendship.
Yeah, no, it is. It's something that I've spoken about and written about. It's something that I guess I picked up from Ivan Illich and from some of his friends and collaborators who I've got to know. And I was in Mexico a couple of years ago filming some conversations with Gustavo Esteva, who's an extraordinary activist and writer and thinker there, somebody who's been involved in the Zapatistas, in UNITIERRA, which is an indigenous grassroots education movement in Oaxaca. And he was talking about the common, the historical commons and the forms of land management and indigenous culture across Latin America that resemble the way that the commons used to work in the English rural areas. And then he was talking about new commons today. And he said, you know, the place where the commons starts today, especially in the rich countries, especially in cities, is with friendship, is with the ways of being together that we have as friends. And that's something that he would very much trace back to Illich. And he said, yeah, Illich used to talk about friendship as the category through which we could begin to reorganize society. And in a lot of ways, that seems absurd. It seems an absurdly fragile, small starting point for facing up to things of the scale and the darkness, the crises that we've been talking about with Dark Mountain. But one of the projects that I have at the moment is trying to elaborate on and make sense of that wild suggestion that friendship might actually be one of the key places of hope, one of the places from which a new kind of politics even might begin to emerge.
But you can't do it without conversation, right?
There are no friendships in theory. There are only friendships in practice, aren't there? And you know, the reality of a friendship grows out of an encounter. It grows out of a conversation, not all of which is necessarily in the form of word. As a writer, one of the most liberating things for me has been working with performers, musicians, improvisers, people who work through physical practices, dancers, who remind me that this very kind of culturally prestigious form of language, and particularly of written words, that is both the sort of natural medium for me and the prison for my way of work, is only part of a larger conversation within which we're all involved. But yeah, the connection between conversation and friendship, and then from there to hospitality and a whole set of other ideas that link to what the commons means in my understanding of it. There's a whole logic there which is quite different to the logics by which we have been organizing our societies.
And you said you're working on this as one of your projects?
Yeah, in lots of different ways. It's something I've been giving talks about and writing about, and working with a filmmaker here in Sweden at the moment to explore the possibility of making a film together around it. So it's one of those kind of lines of inquiry for me at the moment.
Thank you very much. Dougal, before we end though, if people want to connect to you personally, to the Dark Mountain Project, to future gatherings in Europe or in England, what should they do?
So if people want to connect to Dark Mountain and find out about the books and also about future gatherings in England and elsewhere, the place to start is the Dark Mountain website. That's dark-mountain.net. Or if you just Google Dark Mountain, then you'll get to it pretty straightforwardly. And similarly, if you're interested in my work and my writing and the other things that I do, you can either Google my name or you can go to Dougald, which is dougald.nu, and you'll find my website there.
And are there any other gatherings that are coming up?
The next things that I'm aware of off the top of my head are the Prophets of Rock and Wave weekend that Paul is doing with the storyteller Martin Shaw. And that's coming up, I think that's around the end of October. And then next spring, there will be Carrying the Fire, which is a Dark Mountain small festival that happens in Scotland every year. But there are other things going on as well. So if you sign up at the Dark Mountain website, you'll get updates when events are happening.
Thank you very much for being on my program today.
Thank you.
Heard Dougald Hine talking via Skype from Sweden about the Dark Mountain cultural movement. Tidings is heard on the second Wednesday of each month at 7:30 p.m. on WPKN Radio. All Tidings programs are produced by Tony Ernst and archived at hazelkahn.com.